reconvene. Your silence is commanded. Please be seated. Good afternoon. I'm calling our last case for today, 01-2959, Vera Hudson versus Wisconsin Personnel Commission. Representing the State of Wisconsin Personnel Commission is David Rice. Mr. Rice.
May it please the Court, I'm David Rice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I appear in this case on behalf of the State of Wisconsin Personnel Commission. Seated at council table to my right is Richard Moriarty, also an Assistant Attorney General, who authored the amicus brief for the Department of Corrections in this case. This is a case that arises under the Wisconsin whistleblower law. Ms. Vera Hudson was an employee, or is an employee, but for purpose of this case, was an employee of the Department of Corrections working as a probation and parole agent in Milwaukee. And she received a written reprimand. And she appealed her reprimand to the Wisconsin Personnel Commission under two statutes, the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act and the Wisconsin Whistleblower Law. As to the claim under the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, she claimed that she had been retaliated against unlawfully. The agency contended that she was reprimanded for cause. The Personnel Commission decided that the reprimand was motivated by the cause concerns and was not retaliatory. That issue is not before the court. It was raised in circuit court but abandoned in the Court of Appeals. So we're only here on the question of the whistleblower law. Now, usually I don't speak to the question of standard of review because I have a rather cynical belief that judges decide cases the way they think they ought to be decided and then look to standard of review and write that section last. But in this case, it assumes some great importance, and that's why I need to discuss it with you, because this case may illustrate a basis for my cynicism. In the Court of Appeals, in this case, in their decision issued on September 10th, the court, at footnote number 11, said that we believe that something seriously amiss has occurred in this case, and we want to exercise our authority to remand this case in the interest of justice. Well, I wrote a letter to the court after I got that September 10th decision, and I said, are you aware of the decision of the Supreme Court that says that in proceedings under Chapter 227, that in the interest of justice statute cannot apply? So the court considered that, and 2 weeks later it issued the decision which is now before you. And in footnote number 11 they said, we realize that we cannot act in the interest of justice, but we read Section 227.57 sub 4 to say that if we think something's unfair, we can reverse because it's, in effect, substantively unfair. Whatever else you do in this case with respect to the whistleblower law, it's most important that you address that footnote and reverse it, because it would create a terrible precedent for review of administrative agency decisions in all other cases. 227.54 says that the court can reverse if there has been an error in procedure that affects the fairness of the proceedings and that was material to the outcome of the case. There's no claim here that there was any procedural error. What the Court of Appeals has done is to take what essentially is a procedural fairness statute and convert it into a substantive fairness statute, and that simply is improper. What this Court has before it is a question of law, which is a separate grounds for judicial review. It is not a question of procedure, nor does the Court of Appeals nor any reviewing court have authority to remand simply because it thinks something is unfair. If there's a question of evidence involved, which could arise if this case is remanded back to the Commission and then were to come back to this Court, there's a substantial evidence rule that governs that type of review, and even there, courts must be pretty deferential. Now, I'd like to turn also, as long as I'm speaking of standard of review, to what is the appropriate standard of review for the legal conclusions reached by the Commission in this case. We believe that the Circuit Court got it right. The Circuit Court said that the Commission in this area, their interpretations of the whistleblower law are entitled to great weight. Meets all the criteria. The Commission's interpreted and applied the law. It's the agency charged with applying the law. It may not have addressed this specific question, but it has applied the whistleblower law in general, and what this Court has said in terms of expertise, it doesn't have to have the exact factual issue or the exact legal question as long as it has expertise in applying the law in general. So we would urge you to adopt what the Circuit Court adopted in this case, which was the great weight standard. Under that standard, the Commission's interpretation prevails even if another interpretation were determined by this Court to be more reasonable. The Court of Appeals said that...
Why is it great weight here? How many cases have they had? What's the experience with the law? I mean, those are the kinds of things. I mean, the Department obviously is in charge of personnel under the statutes, but what is it that gives them great weight? Not just because the statute puts them as the administrative agency, right?
That's right. They have to have had experience of longstanding and have used that experience and specialized knowledge in particular cases. If you look at page 15 and 16 of my brief, I list decisions of the Commission ranging from 1988 to 1997, in which the Court addressed, which the Commission addressed the type of issue that's before the Court today, that is, what does the word mismanagement mean within the meaning of the whistleblower law? Now, the Court of Appeals said that it was going to apply the due weight standard, which means that if there is a more reasonable interpretation than that of the Commission, the Court can choose that more reasonable interpretation. But the Court of Appeals also said that even if they were applying the great weight standard, they would reach the same result. So they must have believed that there was a more reasonable interpretation of the statute than that adopted by the Commission. We hope to show you in this argument that that is not the case. The statute involved in this case is the Wisconsin whistleblower law. It protects employees who disclose information which the employee reasonably believes demonstrates one of two things, well, actually one of a series of things. First, a violation of any state or federal law, rule, or regulation. And I'm referring you now to Section 230.80 sub 5. It's a definition of information. Second, information includes mismanagement, that's one. Abuse of authority in any state or local government, that's two. Substantial waste of public funds, that's the third. And a danger to public health and safety, that's the fourth. So there's four kinds of information, at least, that will suffice under the whistleblower law. What this case is focused on, however, is just the first, just mismanagement. The reason that it's focused on mismanagement is that that's what Ms. Hudson argued was the basis for her claim in her post-hearing brief to the Commission.
Counsel, in looking, in preparing for these oral arguments, it appeared to me that even though that's what she raised in her brief, and you said that's why we're focusing on mismanagement, because that's why it's raised in the brief, that danger to public safety came to mind. As a circuit court judge, I was concerned when the caseloads of probation parole agents became exceedingly high, because that meant that a lot of their clients they weren't seeing on a regular basis, that people were falling through the cracks, and that wasn't just bad for the agent or the clients, but for the protection of the public. Some of these people needed close monitoring, and they weren't getting close monitoring. Why does the danger to the public safety component not apply here?
Well, it doesn't apply here because it wasn't litigated. Had the complainant raised that as the issue and the Department of Corrections had the opportunity to respond to it, then perhaps the commission would have decided that. It seems to me it's essentially a waiver on the part of Hudson of that issue. Otherwise, the commission would have addressed it, presumably the lower courts would have addressed it, and we may not have been here focusing on the meaning of this other term of mismanagement. It's just the way the case was litigated. It was an option selected by the respondent in this court. Now, mismanagement is defined in the statute to mean, and this is the critical language, a pattern of incompetent management actions which are wrongful, negligent, or arbitrary and capricious, and which adversely affect the efficient accomplishment of an agency function. And then there's the second sentence that says mismanagement does not mean the mere failure to act in accordance with a particular opinion regarding management techniques. So the question is, what does the word pattern mean? Now, the Circuit Court and the Commission believed the pattern had one meaning. The Court of Appeals believed that the word had a second meaning. I think on appeal or on review here, the parties may be arguing and addressing themselves to perhaps a third meaning. And if that's true, then perhaps people can reasonably differ as to what the meaning of the statute is, in which case it would be permissible to resort to legislative history to try to determine the meaning. Now, let me again put this in context. We have a whistleblower claim. To enjoy protection under the whistleblower statute, the law says that you have to disclose information, and the disclosure has to be in writing, and in this case it met the criteria of a written disclosure to a supervisor. Once that disclosure is made to an agency or a governmental unit, that governmental unit must review the information and determine first whether it merits further investigation. That initial determination of whether further investigation is warranted will be guided by your decision in this case about the meaning of the statute. Once the determination is made that investigation is warranted, the investigation must be commenced within 30 days and must be completed within a reasonable period of time. If an agency then disciplines an employee, the employee is entitled to bring a retaliation claim alleging that the basis for the discipline, in this case the reprimand, is the disclosure of the information.
I ask a question. If one act of mismanagement is disclosed before discipline is initiated, but only one, suppose 25 more acts of mismanagement, some of a completely different character, are alleged after discipline is initiated. Does that help the complainant?
Well, I don't see how it could, because the discipline would be imposed at a point in time, and if it's alleged that the discipline were imposed for something that preceded it, for some disclosure of information before it, I guess I fail to see how a disclosure of information after the imposition of discipline could go to the question of impermissible motivation in imposing the discipline.
Well, for purposes of this case, do all of the disclosures have to have come on or before April 19th, 19, I think it's 96?
Before the imposition of the discipline? I would think.
The imposition of the discipline came after the initiation of the, I think there was a filing of something on April 19th.
I think that subsequent disclosures would give rise to additional claims. but I don't see how it could give rise to a claim based on discipline that precedes it.
Well, let's see here. Retaliatory action, 230.83. No appointing authority, agent or appointing authority or supervisor, may initiate any retaliatory action against an employee. And if it said only that, I don't think there'd be any question that you have a date, April 19th, and it has to be on or before that date. But it says may initiate or administer. And it would seem to me the administer might imply something other than initiate.
Well, perhaps I'm failing to appreciate the significance of your question, Your Honor. If you look at 230.80 sub 8, it defines retaliatory action to mean a disciplinary action taken because of any of the following, including the fact that an employee has disclosed information. And then 230.83 makes it unlawful to take discipline or to retaliate, incorporating that definition of retaliation. I'm not sure if the addition of the word administer to the statute other than initiate would cause a different outcome, at least in the way I'm interpreting the statute.
Well, your position is that one perfectly good complaint about mismanagement, there's no problem about retaliatory action following that, just if it's just one. Is that right?
That's right, because it wouldn't suffice to satisfy the definition of pattern. We think that, and I'll get to that in a minute, but I think that that's what the legislature meant something by the inclusion of that word, because it wasn't in the original statute.
Okay. Now, suppose I buy into that. Just one permits you to initiate retaliatory action without consequence. But this says simply no appointing authority may initiate or administer. And the initiation and the administration are different dates, aren't they?
They conceivably could be. Let's take the typical discipline of a state employee to which constitutional protections apply, so that in advance of imposing any discipline, you have to offer the employee an opportunity to be heard, to explain to the employee what you believe the employee has done, to offer the employee an opportunity to offer mitigating circumstances or an explanation. The initiation of the discipline might be in the nature of that pre-disciplinary hearing. The administration of the discipline, I assume, to the extent that the statute doesn't have surplusage, would be the imposition of the discipline. That's the way I would read initiate or administer. To use your example, let's say that the person filed a retaliation claim, and there was a single incident, and it was dismissed under the Commission's reading of the statute as being inadequate. And let's say there were subsequent disclosures. Seems to me then, if there is no discipline taken after that, there's no action. But if there is another discipline imposed, then you can go back and incorporate not only those that occurred subsequent to the initial discipline, but the ones prior to that, and aggregate them for purposes of stating a claim. Now, to get back to the definition of mismanagement, when the bill was introduced in the legislature, it simply said mismanagement. There was no definition. And two state agencies, the Wisconsin Department of Employment Relations and the Department of Administration, were concerned about that because they were afraid that it would be too broad, that any complaint about any insignificant management action could be brought to the governmental unit, and they'd have to investigate, and and potentially could lead to litigation before the commission. And so the language was added that's there currently, a pattern of incompetent management actions, plus the language taken over a period of time. The taken over a period of time language was deleted before the bill was passed. The Court of Appeals seemed to think that that meant it's okay to have a single action to suffice for a pattern because they took out the language over a period of time. We read the legislative history differently. We read the legislative drafter at face value as saying that she took out words that she thought were redundant, and we think that's redundant to the word pattern.
So it means the same thing as over a period of time.
Right.
Which means, why isn't this over a period of time? This is 319 points above the 260. Did that occur in one day?
Here's how I would respond to that. First of all, and I know that we can disregard what the lower courts have done, that you have plenary authority under Chapter 227 to reach your own decision. The quarrel that we had with the Court of Appeals decision, and I think actually Ms. Hudson agrees that seizing on the word, using the word single action may not be sufficient. What Ms. Hudson argues here is that if there is a single decision made, if there is a single decision made, in this case, the decision to assign X number of cases to probation and parole agents in that work unit, if those cases are assigned to those agents over a period of time, according to that formula and that initially decided amount, that's a pattern. And I think that's the crux of the argument that they're making here. We would say that that isn't a pattern. We would say there's a single decision here, and the fact that it's implemented over a period of time doesn't convert it into a pattern. It may, for purposes of liberally construing a statute, be enough to toll the statute of limitations so that an event occurring within that period is sufficient. But we think we've got a single decision here and not a pattern.
Would it be a pattern if it occurred not just to Ms. Hudson but to two of her co-workers? Would that then qualify for mismanagement, pattern of mismanagement?
I don't think in this instance it would, if I want to restrict myself to the facts of this case, because the same rule was applied evenly to all members of the work unit. We contend it was a single decision to assign a certain number of cases. Actually, and this perhaps is my labor law background, to me this is a garden variety labor issue as to whether or not the cases are being assigned in excess of that permitted under the bargaining agreement. As far as we can tell from the record, the union never took that issue on, never took it to arbitration, and so we don't know the answer to that question.
Now, if it's not mismanagement, what's the result? The management can retaliate?
If it's not mismanagement, if it doesn't fall within the definition of mismanagement, it is therefore not a lawful disclosure of information. The employee enjoys no protection, and yes, to the extent that the employers, and I'm not saying in this case that corrections did anything wrong, to the contrary, the Commission found under the Fair Employment Act claim that they acted for legitimate, permissible reasons. But yes, to answer your question, applying the statutory definitions, there would be no liability under the statute.
Your definition is, let me work backward, a single decision extending over a period of time does not equal a pattern. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's correct.
Well, let me tell you my problem and see how you can address it. My problem is this, that this concept is amorphous. Whether or not a single decision extending over a period of time really equals a series of events or a single. And I think it's all the way you look at it. And one person may look at it one way and another way. Let me ask the question. In Genesis, creation of the earth, is that a single event? Is that a single decision?
I really don't want to offer a religious view, but
no. I'm assuming that you're familiar with that. As written is, and I'm not speaking of truth necessarily in essence, but as written is the creation of the world, a single decision extending over a period of time.
Let me answer it this way, because I think you've answered your question earlier in your preface to the question. The way I view this, it's essentially a labeling exercise.
It's a what?
It's a labeling exercise. It's reasonable people could look at the same event and say it's either or.
Yes, maybe that is my point, yeah.
And I think that's correct. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, ultimately, ironically, this case might turn on the standard of review then, because if the statute could be read reasonably either way, we would submit that the court should defer to the agency that has the expertise.
To finish the point, a reasonable argument, I think, can be made that it was a series of 6 days in a reading of that reading of that portion of the Bible, the light and then rocks and then animals, you know. And there's another argument that can be said that the decision was a single decision. So it's just an amorphous sort of concept, I think.
Right.
You don't disagree.
I do not disagree with that. There's many issues that come before the court in which you can look at the same issue and you struggle with trying to say what it is. Labor relations, you have the question, is class size a permissive subject of bargaining because it's a matter of educational policy, or is it a mandatory subject of bargaining because it's a condition of a teacher's employment? This court's grappled with that kind of issue.
But even then, under the due weight standard of review, the agency is upheld.
It is, unless
even if we don't apply the higher standard of review, the agency
right.
is upheld because two reasonable interpretations in that situation, the tie goes to the agency.
That's right. And the agency reverses only in the event you determine that the opposite view is more reasonable.
So then you have to get to the legislative history and intent. And
right. And I think that, as I was saying, when you look at the legislative history, it's clear that the word pattern of incompetent management actions was added at the request of these two state agencies because there was a concern about the scope of the statute and the extent to which these issues would have to be investigated and litigated. I can't read any more into it than that. That's all that we know.
The analysis isn't there's two reasonable views, and I'm asking this question. There's two reasonable views, and tie goes to the agency. Isn't it this, that there are two reasonable views, but after applying our tools of statutory construction, one may be more reasonable than the other. And so, if, let's say, your opposing counsel is the more reasonable, then there is no tie. How do you respond to that?
May I respond? My time is up.
You may respond.
I would answer it this way. We would suggest to the court, the commission would suggest to the court, that they aren't equally reasonable.
That what?
I'm sorry.
That they are not equally reasonable, given the legislative history. When I responded to your question, in the abstract, I think that's absolutely true if we're just looking at the word pattern. But I think that that there was an intention to be limiting here. And I also think that if you look at the definitions in the dictionary of pattern and what it connotes, you plug it into the statute. It's in my brief. Just look at that. And I think that you'd come away thinking that the approach taken by the commission is the more reasonable of the two approaches. I see my time is up.
But I again have problems with if it was just Ms. Hudson. Okay, then maybe I agree with you. But what if there were three people, all of whom had excess workload? Is that a series, a pattern of mismanagement, or does management get a pass on that also?
Well, I hate to respond to it as if they get a pass or as if they've done anything wrong, because I don't think the record sustains that, and I think there's a presumption of regularity on the part of governmental agencies. But to answer your question, no, I don't think it is a pattern yet, Justice Babbage. I think that there's a single decision here, and again, we're labeling it. I mean, if I was in Mr. Olson's shoes, I could try to argue convincingly to you that it was a pattern because it was carried out over a period of time. But I'm representing the commission, and they believe that the more reasonable interpretation is the opposite interpretation.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Olson, representing Vera Hudson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Evidence of pattern in this case comes from a variety of sources, and it is true that the conduct of which Ms. Hudson complained affected a number of individuals, starting with Ms. Hudson, her two co-workers, Ms. McKinstry, Ms. Turner, the offenders in the program, and ultimately the public. And the Court of Appeals was very astute to pick up on the overall impact of the decisions being made and the patterns existing in the conduct of which Ms. Hudson complained. The genesis of The pattern in this case began on February 5, 1996, when Ms. Hudson issued her memo and specifically complained about, number one, workload relief. She cited specifically to the exceeding the cap pursuant to the collective bargaining agreement on caseload assignment, and she complained about the arbitrary and capricious management of of Mr. Wake, the supervisor. And this is significant because she was asking for establishment of policies and procedures in order to run the department in a uniform manner. She also said that all of these things she identified in her memo were important so that she could uphold her affirmative duty to serve and protect the public. Now, these same issues were raised again by Ms. Hudson on March 15 in a written memo to Mr. Kasperzak. She again referred back to her original memo and addressed the same problem that was ongoing with respect to the workload issue. Then Mr. Kasperzak held three meetings that we're aware of on March 19, 1996. And based on the first meeting on that day with Ms. Hudson, Ms. McKinstry, and Ms. Turner, and again, they were selected out individually. It was not something that was affecting everyone in the unit uniformly. It was affecting and impacting more harshly on these three individuals who were complaining. After that first meeting, Mr. Kasperzak issued a written memo. And in that memo, he set forth five things that needed to be done. The first thing was that he was going to get some specific legal authority regarding the caseload classification. He was also going to check on the status of the memo of understanding between management and the collective bargaining unit with respect to whether this department would be exempt from the caps that were applied to caseload. He also said that he was going to bring up the issues raised by Ms. Hudson in the next regional chiefs meeting. And finally, he secured a pledge and entered a pledge himself to foster mutual respect and a harassment-free work environment. We have to ask ourselves the question, if these were issues concerning only Ms. Hudson's opinion about management techniques, would Mr. Kasperzak be issuing a directive to create specific policies, practices, and procedures in a written form? This was not Ms. Hudson's opinion. These were ongoing issues that Ms. Hudson had identified, and at least in writing, Mr. Kasperzak picked up on that and indicated he was going to devote the DOC's resources to take care of it. We also have to ask ourselves, if this was only Ms. Hudson's opinion that we were dealing with, rather than a pattern in practice, would Mr. Kasperzak be spending the DOC's resources to secure a formal legal opinion regarding the caseload caps? And it's also clear that Mr. Kasperzak would not have raised merely Ms. Hudson's opinions in the regional chiefs' meetings. These were issues that she identified in her original February memo and continued, and Mr. Kasperzak recognized these in writing in his March 19 memo.
Counsel, Mr. Olson.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. I have a question regarding why it was brought on, why you're bringing this, relying solely on this pattern of mismanagement. I realize that the Court of Appeals said, well, in fact, I have problems with this from the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals says, what possible purpose could be served by requiring a probation parole agent to await a series of actions before alerting superiors to a single action, establishing a pattern that endangers our citizens? Well, I would respond to the Court of Appeals by saying, well, you don't have to wait, because subsection 5 sub B says a substantial or a danger to public health and safety. So why aren't you relying on on that?
You know, as this case has evolved, Justice Babbage, perspectives, I think, have changed, and I think the Court of Appeals raised an interesting point.
Well, it's a common-sense point that they raised, but it seems to me that they raised it as if there was no answer, and it seems clear that the statutes provide the answer.
Well, the statute certainly provides protection if that issue is raised, and Ms. Hudson did raise that in her memo. So I think protection may, in fact, be triggered under that prong of the statute. The other side of that is that this was a minimum security program, and was there really danger to the public? I don't know if that can be answered in the affirmative. The main focus of Ms. Hudson was mismanagement and trying to do her job and to be treated like the other individuals in order to carry out her responsibilities to the public.
How did she raise the issue of public safety?
In her original memo, by addressing it as her affirmative duty.
I'm sorry.
Her affirmative duty as a probation parole officer having a responsibility to the public. What she identified.
Isn't that argument sort of undercut by, she just asked for overtime pay or something?
Well, she had asked either to have either overtime or a reduction in the number of cases assigned. The problem was the number of cases combined with lacking documentation and no policies or procedures in the department, there was no control or no process to follow to make sure that everything was done properly.
You cited the March 15th letter that the complainant wrote to Mr. Kasperzak, which I believe is on page 158 of the appendix, as part of the commission's decision. But I don't understand that you're relying on that memo for anything, or at least if you are relying on the memo, why didn't the commission discuss that as one of the releases of information or triggering acts or whatever you call it?
Your Honor, once the disclosure occurs, protection under the Act is triggered. And that protection was triggered by the memo back in February. That memo was the most specific reference to the caseload, the problems with arbitrary and capricious management, and while the subsequent memos refer back to the original memo, the disclosure had already occurred back in February. So the subsequent memos are referring back to, again, stating to Mr. Kasperzak that she had provided him with the original memo, and she again identifies what she had identified back in February concerning workload relief. So but the subsequent memos are relevant, Your Honor, to the issue of whether this was a pattern ongoing of mismanagement.
I'm not quite gathering this. The overload of work, it seems to me, is one example of potential mismanagement. But discussions about being fearful, that strikes me as something wholly different. It is in a memorandum written to a bunch of supervisors before any discipline is initiated. Why isn't that counted?
And it may be, Your Honor, that should be counted as well as an additional type of
counsel,
disclosure.
Counsel, I'm sorry. You have to stand in front of the microphone because you're being taped.
Thank you, Your Honor. And that it identifies a different type of conduct that, as this situation evolved, continued to be a problem, and it was then addressed in the third of the March 19, 1996 meetings. And that's why the pledge that Mr. Kasperzak secured is so significant here. At the end of the first meeting, he secured a pledge to say, everyone is going to play nice here. We're going to have a harassment-free environment. And within minutes, he met with Ms. Hudson's two supervisors. This is what he told the supervisors. He said, and I'm quoting from paragraph 12 of the Court of Appeals decision, the strategy is to separate the troublemakers and grind them down one by one. So setting aside for a moment the retaliatory motive of that statement, we need to take a close look at the terminology he uses. He says strategy. He's not talking about an isolated incident. He's talking about an ongoing pattern and practice, the very things that Ms. Hudson was complaining about with respect to arbitrary and capricious management. Mr. Kasperzak goes on to say to the managers, the way to beat a bully is to beat him senseless. Again, he's talking about a way, a method, and a means. He's also talking about past practice because the woman, the supervisor, Ms. Ware, to whom he is speaking with Mr. Wake, had filed a harassment complaint against Mr. Kasperzak only months previously. Again, it's not an isolated issue that's being raised. It's that top management directing management beneath him how they're to carry out their jobs as managers. He goes on to say, I just ignore harassment complaints against me. It's not one complaint. He's using plural. And he actually gives an example of former complaints in addition to the one that Ms. Ware had filed against him. He goes on to say the department will write it out and the complainant will be bought off. The reward to them is piddly. He's actually predicting what will happen based on his own experience. He even cites a specific example in that case. Finally, he says to Mr. Wake, this is all part of being a manager. He's not talking about Ms. Hudson's opinion. He's not talking about an isolated event. He's saying that in reference to grinding down employees, beating them senseless, and ignoring their complaints is part and parcel to being a manager for the Department of Corrections. One of my favorite quotes from the hearing in this case was by Ms. Ware when she said that she doesn't frighten easily. She's worked with murderers, but she's afraid of Mr. Kasperzak. And after Mr. Kasperzak issued these directives, within weeks, Mr. Wake and Ms. Ware carried out those retaliatory directives.
Let me give you my take on this case and see if we can't resolve. Well, I know we can't resolve this, but it seems to me that we got two lawyers wrestling here, and both for very understandable reasons. You want to provide protection to Vera Hudson against retaliatory action.
And others like her.
Yeah. And the state seems to me to also have a very understandable goal, which is to make sure that the phrase mismanagement does not become a catch-all.
Correct.
They want to get it defined specifically and precisely so that we've got some order in the law. And that's very understandable also. But meanwhile, that tug of war between you and Mr. Rice puts Vera Hudson in a very difficult position, if not untenable, because while you guys are wrestling, she's getting trampled, assuming that, you know, she had a legitimate complaint. Now, can't that be resolved? Can't we have both winners here? I can't believe that Mr. Rice wants to see that Ms. Hudson is treated unjustly, but he's got an absolute duty to see that the law is interpreted correctly.
Absolutely. And as I stated in my brief, we agree with some of the things that the state has said, and there are certain aspects of the Court of Appeals definition, or tied in at least with the definitions found in the dictionary.
Well, is there any way we can go back and say, okay, Ms. Hudson, You deserve protect. We have taken this case down the wrong path by trying to slip it into that mismanagement category. And rather, it should go down the path of slipping it into she's got a legitimate concern about public safety. Any way to get back to that point?
Procedurally, I'm not aware of that, Your Honor, but these were concerns that she had raised, and the Court of Appeals, as I said, picked up on that as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Court of Appeals said, and I'm reading from paragraph 31, that her memo asking reasonable guidelines presented more than a personal complaint of a mere failure to act in accordance with a particular opinion, which I gather was the Commission's position under 80 paren 7's paren. Here again, we could note that the Commission, at both portions of its decision where it quoted Hudson's memo, deleted critical words. It failed to quote, colon, quote, to best meet the needs of the protection of the community and the Department of Corrections and herself as agent in the minimum administrative unit. And here again, the deleted words weave into much more than personal matters or particular opinions regarding management techniques. While the Commission argues clear that Hudson simply disagreed with DOC's management about what was or was not an excessive caseload, Hudson's memo emphatically and specifically expressed far more than disagreement and goes on to say that the heart of this is the provision of services to protect the public. Is that far-fetched, or is it borne out by the record, or is
it's not
the Court of Appeals making it up?
No, it's not far-fetched. It's addressed in her memo, and I think they're addressing the mismanagement prong of the statute through the public safety prong of the statute through the mismanagement prong to say that the mismanagement she was complaining of directly affected this unit's operation and the protection and safety of the public.
This is the way that I read the memo, and I'm looking at the memo, just happens to be on page 5 of the state's brief that I'm looking at. And I look at that memo, and when I read it, I thought, okay, what does she want? And the very first sentence of that excerpted memo on page 5 of the state's brief says she wants this. I want workload relief and or authorized overtime. That's the very beginning. And then you go to the very end and she asks for one more thing. At the very last sentence, she says, I am at this time requesting that reasonable guidelines be established that would enable me to perform my job to best meet the needs of the protection of the community, the DOC, and myself as agent, etc. So I read this as she's asking for three things. I don't know if my reading's correct, but at the very beginning she asked for two, and the third thing, guidelines for the to meet the needs of the protection of the community. And then I read this also as, so what is she complaining about? She's complaining about, number one, excessive workload. Number two, a caseload that continues to grow without a foreseeable end. Number three, that's coupled with lack of clarity under a supervisory style. And number four, the supervisory style is extremely arbitrary and capricious. So I'm not sure that I'm reading it correctly, but I see those as her complaints and that deal with caseload and supervisory, management style, arbitrary, capricious, lack of clarity. She's asking for three things. Am I reading it correctly or incorrectly?
There's
more. I don't mean to be throwing you a puffball question. I'm wondering, am I reading it correctly or incorrectly in terms of what she wants and why?
It's directly from her memo, and these were her requests consistently throughout her oral and written communications with management.
So why can't we say that this doesn't fit under the rubric of mismanagement, but send it back to the Personnel Commission, tell them to try it under the right section.
I think it could be tried under both sections.
What was it tried under? That's what counts.
It was addressed, the issue was identified as mismanagement.
Right, so it's too late to try to retry it under alternate theories under the statute. You had an opportunity, you didn't. You argued it only under the mismanagement prong of the statute. If it doesn't fall under that because it doesn't meet the statutory definition, then it's too late to start offering alternate arguments. Wouldn't you concede that at this point, as you have to procedurally?
Procedurally, I'm not aware of a way to send it back to the commission to add a separate
arguments
claim.
Arguments you didn't make back then.
However, the argument has always been made that the through Ms. Hudson's disclosures, the mismanagement she's complaining of directly impacted on her affirmative duty to the department and to the public. And that's where the Court of Appeals came in to say that she's identified that as an issue here. And these complaints do, in fact, impede her ability to carry out the specific tasks set out in her.
Counsel, you didn't argue that at the commission level. You argued only the mismanagement theory, right?
Correct. The broad mismanagement theory, that is the prong, and that is her complaint that this mismanagement, this ongoing conduct, is impeding her ability to do her job.
Right. And the analysis was confined to the February 5th memo, as it had to be, because that was the only quote-unquote protected disclosure that could possibly be implicated by this statute.
Well,
it can't be the other stuff that happened afterwards.
Well, the analysis actually is not quite that narrow. The disclosure certainly occurred on February 5, 1996. However, the meetings orally and all of the memos that were written after that disclosure are taken into account to define the pattern and the ongoing problem, the evolution of this problem.
The statute protects only disclosures.
Correct.
And so that's why we have to confine ourselves under this statute. The fair employment claim is something else, but that's no longer before us. What is before us right now is only the whistleblower statute claim, and we have to keep our eye on the ball. And the whistleblower statute only protects disclosures of mismanagement, disclosures of violations of public safety, disclosures as otherwise defined in the statute. The only disclosure that was argued here by you was the February 5th memo, and the only theory under the statute, the only definition under the statute that was argued was mismanagement. So everything that happened afterwards is irrelevant to determine whether the statutory protection was even triggered in the first instance. And any alternate theory under the statute is likewise irrelevant.
I disagree with that, and none of my discussion today has had anything to do with the Wisconsin Fair Employment Act, specifically under the whistleblower law and looking at the disclosure. In order to determine what is being disclosed, it is important to look at the circumstances surrounding the disclosure. And if we're going to identify
the disclosure itself, you don't look at extraneous evidence. You look at the disclosure to see if it was protected, to determine whether she was being retaliated against because of that disclosure. So we are confined to that February 5th memo, as I understand the law.
Respectfully, I would state that the subsequent activities that would indicate whether there is an ongoing pattern of conduct of which she is complaining will dictate whether that initial disclosure is protected.
That's bootstrapping.
The Court of Appeals in its decision had cited authority, and I tend to agree with their analysis on that point, Your Honor.
Now, you think that the three types of information are mutually exclusive? It says mismanagement,
Then it says abuse of authority. So maybe there's four things here. And there's a comma. Substantial waste of public funds or a danger to public health and safety. Can't mismanagement also be a substantial waste of public funds or abuse of authority or substantial waste of public funds or also a danger to public health and safety?
It could fall under those additional categories as well.
But you didn't argue any of that.
I'm sorry?
You did not argue any of that in the
We commission. Argued that the it was mismanagement. Then on April 22, 1996, Ms. Hudson issued a memo to Mr. Sullivan, the secretary, again, specifically stating that the intimidation had increased after she issued her original memo in February of 1996. She again identified workload relief, and she asked for help. And that's the very purpose of the whistleblower statute, to try to work out these issues with management, bring it to their attention, try to resolve these things without any retaliation, and only as a last resort, if that doesn't work, finally file a complaint with the commission. And that's exactly what Ms. Hudson did in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Rice?
May it please the Court. One lesson I've learned being a lawyer as long as I have is that just because you're allotted 5 minutes doesn't mean that you ought to use it all. And I don't intend to, but I would like to try to respond to some of the questions that were asked while Mr. Olson was up here. First of all, I think Justice Sykes has put this case in its proper perspective. This is the reply brief, or the brief that the Ms. Hudson filed after the hearing. And in her brief, she limits her complaint, her argument to mismanagement. She limits her factual basis to the February work memo, period. Justice Babich, could we somehow get it back to treat her fairly? Well, I want to be careful now because I don't think that one's perception of the facts, even though we've had a closing argument here, should govern how we approach this question of law here. And I think that was the pitfall that the Court of Appeals fell in when it was making its decision in this case. If you decide that the disclosure constitutes mismanagement, as it's been litigated, and that's the only issue that's been litigated, then you'll send it back to the Commission. And the Commission will then hold a hearing and will determine whether or not the action taken, the reprimand, was a retaliatory action based on the lawful disclosure or was for the reasons articulated by DOC for its action. Same reasons that under the Fair Employment Act, the Commission determined were the reasons and were not retaliation. But there might be a different outcome here because there's a presumption of retaliation under the Whistleblower Act, which would arguably apply and did not apply in that case. Answering your question, Justice Abramson.
Wait, let's stay on my question.
Well, I was going to answer it and bring it right back to yours.
The point, did you take exception to my saying that your primary interest in this case is to make sure that we don't gobble up or Google up the definition of what's mismanagement?
That's all that we're here for. That was actually what Justice Abramson asked. Well, can't you take mismanagement in that series of types of information that constitute protected disclosures and incorporate them back into mismanagement? I don't think so. I think there are four separate categories, some of which, like abuse of authority, is separately defined by the statute. It may inform your decision somehow, but I think there are four separate categories. And I think all that was litigated in this case was mismanagement. Now, it doesn't mean
as I read sub 5, sub 5 in conjunction with sub B, and what I'm referring to is it would read as follows. Information means information gained by the employee, which the employee reasonably believes demonstrates a danger to public health and safety. And that is distinct from which reasonably demonstrates mismanagement. or demonstrates abuse of authority. These are separate categories. And my concern is for Ms. Hudson that she's getting trampled on this, because it's pretty clear to me, based upon that memo that Justice Bradley read, that February 5th memo, that at least that last sentence indicates she does have a concern for public health and safety.
Right.
And she's not really getting her just due, because she's being shoehorned into a category maybe that she can't win because of the definition of the word mismanagement. And can't we somehow manage to keep the law clear and at the same time provide some kind of justice to Ms. Hudson?
Well, I think that may go to the role of a decision maker, both the Personnel Commission and were this tried in court to a trial court. When a position is advanced on behalf of a client by an attorney, and that's the argument that's made, is it appropriate for the commission? Would it have been appropriate for the commission examiner or the commission in this case to say, you know, we're going to disregard what's said in the brief, and we're going to decide this as a danger to public health and safety issue because that's what we really think it is? How do you think corrections would have felt? Now, I've been a hearing examiner, and I think that
Could they have said to corrections and to Mr. Olson, go brief it?
They could have. And I think there's a line. It's a gray area. And having been a hearing examiner, how much do you let the parties litigate, and how much are they bound by their own actions, and how much do you, because you're the agency enforcing the law, have a role to play in trying to develop the complaint and trying to assist the complainant? If the person's unrepresented, of course, this Court has said that the hearing examiner has an obligation. When the parties are represented by competent counsel, it's a difficult role to be in when you're the hearing examiner as to how far you should go. And I think Justice Sykes has it in this case. I don't think that it was incumbent upon the commission here to look at the case and try to analyze it in as many different aspects as it might have were those arguments advanced. It's essentially a waived argument at this point. And the only issue, the limited issue that we're here to ask you to decide, is what does the word mismanagement mean, so that agencies, when they get information disclosed, and the Personnel Commission, when it decides these cases, will know how to apply the law.
Well, now, let me just ask you, let's stay with mismanagement. Which part of the Court of Appeals decision, or which part of mismanagement, you can ask either one or both, do you think this case does not fall under? Now, we've talked about pattern. But suppose you're wrong about pattern, and suppose Justice Bradley's creation example means that it's not a single decision implemented over several days. So suppose I say there is a pattern here, and that I think that's a reasonable interpretation. So where else doesn't this fall? There's a charge here of incompetent management action that were wrongful, negligent, or arbitrary, and adversely affect the efficient accomplishment of the agency function. The agency function is to provide public safety by supervising vendors. So what else is at stake here other than pattern?
Nothing.
Okay.
What I want to decide.
So it can fit here. It can fit well under management, except for the word pattern. Is that your position?
Yes. And what you have to decide ultimately, if you abide by the standard of review and the amount of deference, even if you apply due deference, you'd have to decide that it's a more reasonable interpretation to label it one way than to label it the other.
And so it all falls on pattern. Now tell us, Mr. Rice, what you want as the what you think is the correct definition of pattern on the basis of the common ordinary meaning of pattern as well as the legislative history.
The legislative history would counsel that it should be construed in a way that is narrower than if the word pattern were not in the statute, because the agencies that came to the legislature, alarmed by the lack of a definition, wanted it to be limited. In terms of the definition, we would suggest that the court adopt the dictionary definition, which suggests that a pattern is, I'm trying to find it in my brief, but in any event, it's not, here it is, right here.
Page
19 of my brief. Pattern defined in Webster's to mean a reliable sample of traits, acts, or other observable features. We believe if you plug that into the statute, it makes more sense. In other words, mismanagement would be a reliable sample of incompetent management actions. If you do it the way the Court of Appeals did it, they would say that you use the word pattern to mean, again citing Webster's, a fully realized form, original, or model accepted or proposed for imitation. And so if you plug that definition in, mismanagement would be a model or example of incompetent management actions. I don't think that the Court of Appeals definition should be adopted by this Court in any event. If you're going to do anything, then adopt the approach that at least has been suggested by counsel and by Justice Bradley, that you could have an act, the consequences of which occur over a period of time, create a pattern. I still think that's less reasonable than the approach the Commission's adopted. But I think, reading the briefs together, that Mr. Olson and I would agree that the decision of the Court of Appeals, unfortunately you granted review, won't stand, and you'll have an opportunity to correct it.
Justice Bradley.
Thank you. I have not read all the stuff in the record, or probably even close to a lot of the stuff in the record, but I want to get to this issue of whether or not the argument as to wanting guidelines be established that would enable me to perform my job to best meet the needs of the protection of the community, whether or not that was never raised or argued or waived. I'm looking at the Personnel Commission decision, and boy, on my copy I have 180. I don't know what that refers to, because I have a copy out of it. Yes.
It's in our appendix beginning at page 145.
Yes, it's page 180 on the bottom, and I'm looking at the paragraph that is the second full paragraph, complainant's comments. Are you tracking with me at all?
I am.
Okay, thank you. And it seems to me, as I read that paragraph, and I start in the second, it says, complainant's comments about, now we're not talking about the arbitrary and capricious the supervisor's style, but I am talking about the lack of reasonable guidelines, and the complainant's request about reasonable guidelines had to do with this need of protection of the community. Are too general and conclusory to satisfy the statutory requirement for making a disclosure of the information. And, of course, they're referring to the February 5th memo, that those comments are for wanting a reasonable guidelines for community safety are too general and conclusory to satisfy the statutory requirement for making a disclosure of information. Continues, complainant's statements could relate to the general concept of mismanagement that is defined, and then it goes on, and I'm skipping that, I don't mean to skip anything important. But I looked at that paragraph as that it was the Personnel Commission that was looking at the February 5th memo and deciding, hey, is there anything here that can meet the definition of, is it information that needs disclosure of information that fits the statute? And the Personnel Commission is saying the only thing in this February 5th memo must be under the management, because I don't think the request for guidelines meets it. My point and my question is this. Is it the Personnel Commission that started this must be management, can't be the guideline request for community safety that's at play, or is it your opposing counsel that framed that as the issue?
The latter.
Making myself clear?
You've made yourself clear. It's the latter. What the Commission said was, we have these post-hearing briefs. We've got page 30 of his brief that says the issue is mismanagement and the issue is this memo. And so when you read that paragraph of their decision, they're saying, how can we squeeze this into mismanagement? And it doesn't seem to us to fit. Now, could they have said, We think this is essentially an allegation of danger to public health and safety, and we don't care what they allege, and we're going to go ahead and decide that as being a colorable claim here and allow the case to go to hearing. That goes to the whole question that I alluded to earlier in response to Justice Babich. Is that permissible for an agency, or ought it defer to the parties to let them litigate it however they will?
Mm-hmm. So their comment that this request for reasonable guidelines, and I'm inserting for the need of the protection of the community, their comment that that's too general to satisfy the statutory requirement for making a disclosure.
No, I think you have to read it in conjunction with the prior sentence. In the prior sentence, they're talking about, does this fit mismanagement? Not does it meet the statute, the statutory disclosure in general. Because arguably it could, as you've read it, and it could be alleged danger to public health and safety. If that had been presented to the commission, they would have decided that. Either party might have disliked their result, and we would have been in the court here on a different issue. We're unfortunately limited by the record that was created and that you have before you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rice, and thank you, Mr. Olson, for your argument in this personnel matter. That ends our hearing on 01-2959 Hudson versus Wisconsin Personnel Commission. The court is in recess until its next oral argument, which I believe is on March 13th.